Nick. 10:15 p.m. A fist hits the window and I jump, letting out a yelp. A flashlight skates across the glass. The security guard gestures for me to roll down the window.
You okay?
He says. I recognize him as one of the men who was standing by the gates, making sure everyone left in an orderly fashion. He probably has instructions to clear the lot, too. My eyes tick to the dashboard. I've been sitting in the car for more than 20 minutes. I'm fine, I say. The guard looks as though he doesn't believe me. He angles a flashlight up to my face, practically blinding me, probably to check my pupils and make sure I'm not drunk or high. I manage to smile. Really? I was just leaving.
All right, then,
he says, rapping the outside of my car once with his knuckles, for emphasis.
Just make sure you finish texting before you get on the road.
I realize I'm still gripping Dara's phone in my hand. I will, I say as he turns, satisfied, back toward the gates. I roll up the window again, twist the key in the ignition, punch on the AC. The security guard's words have given me an idea. I pull up the East Norwalk number attached to the two almost naked photographs and paste it into a new text. For a minute, I sit there, debating, typing, and erasing. Finally, I settle on a simple, "Hey, you around?" It's a crazy gamble, a shot in the dark. I'm not even expecting a response. But almost immediately, Dar's phone dings. I feel a rush of adrenaline all the way to my fingertips. Who is this? I ignore that. Was looking at our pictures again, I write. And then, they're pretty hot. I wipe sweat from my forehead with the inside of my wrist. For a minute, the phone stays silent. My heart is beating so hard I can hear it. Then, just as I'm about to give up and put the car in drive, the phone buzzes twice. Seriously, who is this? I've been unconsciously holding my breath. Now I exhale, a big rush of air, feeling a little like a balloon that has just been punctured. Rationally, I know that the photographs probably don't mean anything. Dara got drunk. She took her clothes off. She let some creep snap some pictures, and now he doesn't even remember. End of story. I can't explain the feeling, nagging, persistent, that there's some connection here. A way of sewing up the story of the past 4 months and making sense of it. It's the same feeling I get when I'm trying to remember the lyrics to a song that keeps looping through my head somewhere just out of reach. I write, "Dara," all caps, and leave it at that. 1 minute passes, then two. Even though the security guard's face is lost in darkness, I can tell he's watching me. Ding. You think this is a fucking joke? Before I can figure out how to respond, another text comes in. I don't know what you think you're playing at, but you better be careful. And then another. This is serious shit. Whatever you know, you better keep your mouth shut or else. The security guard is moving toward me again. I throw Dara's phone in the cup holder, hard, as if I can shatter it and shatter the messages there too. I put the car in drive and find myself halfway up the coast before I even realize I've started for home. I'm going way too fast, 65 according to the speedometer, and I slam on the brakes, blood thumping in my ears and air pounding outside my windows, mirroring the distant noise of the surf. What does it mean? You think this is a fucking joke? I think of Dara the way I saw her earlier, boarding a bus, arms crossed, jumping at the sound of her name. You better keep your mouth shut or else. What the hell has Dara gotten herself into now?
July 28th, Dara's diary entry. Dear Nick, I made up a game. It's called Catch me if you can. D.
Nick, 10:35 p.m. I might as well have chugged a gallon of coffee. I feel ultra-wired, jumpy, and alert. On the drive home, I keep checking the rearview mirror, half expecting to see a stranger sitting in the back seat, leering at me. As soon as I enter the house, I see that Aunt Jackie's bag is gone. She must have decided to go home after all. Mom has fallen asleep in the den, her legs entangled in the blankets, a sure sign of sleeping pills. The light from the TV casts the room in blue, sends shifting patterns over the walls and ceilings, and makes the whole scene look submerged. An orange-hued news anchor gazes seriously into the camera above a blazing red graphic that reads, Snow Conspiracy. A twist in the Madeline Snow case. On screen, the news anchor is saying, We'll have more on the news report from the Snow's neighbor, Susan Hardwell, after the break. I turn off the TV, grateful for the sudden silence. How many times have I heard it in the past week? When a person disappears, the first 72 hours are the most important. I saw Dara just before dinner, only a few hours ago, boarding the bus. But she didn't have a bag with her. And she didn't have her phone. So where the hell could she have been going? In Dara's room, I switch on all the lights, feeling a little bit better, less anxious, once the room is revealed in all its mess and plainness. This time, I know exactly what I'm looking for. Despite all of Dara's whining about privacy, she's too lazy to ever hide things successfully. And I find her journal where it always is, at the very back of the smallest drawer in her rickety side table, behind a tangled mess of pens, old phone chargers, condoms, and gum wrappers. I sit down on her bed, which groans awfully underneath me, as if protesting my trespassing, and open her journal on my lap. My palms are itchy, like they always are when I'm nervous. But I'm compelled by that same indescribable instinct that flattened me all those years ago during that stupid geography test. Dara's in trouble. Dara's been in trouble for a long time, and I'm the only one who can help her. Dara's handwriting looks like it's trying to leap off the paper. The pages of the journal are packed, covered with scrawled notes, doodles, and random observations. It happened, starts one, dating from early January. Parker and I hooked up for real. I flip forward a week. Hookups, breakups, complaints about Mom, Dad, Dr. Lickme, and me. It's all there. All the anger and triumph, all channeled into neatly intersecting lines of ink. Some of it I've seen before. I did once read her journal. After I found out from my friend Isha that she and Ariana had started in on coke. And I read her note to me afterward, taunting, about what had happened at the Founders Day ball. I'm going to tell Mom and Dad their little angel isn't such an angel after all. If only she knew. From February 15th. Happy day after Valentine's Day. I'd like to take whoever invented this holiday out to the backyard for a good old-fashioned firing line. Better yet, just string up Cupid and fire arrows in his stupid fat ass. From February 28th. Parker's in love with somebody else. That one makes my heart turn over a little. And from March 2nd. I guess that's the really nice thing about disappearing. The part where people look for you and beg you to come home. I slow down when I reach March 26th, the day the photographs were sent to her from the East Norwalk number, from the guy who warned me, who warned Dara, to keep her mouth shut. This entry is relatively short, only a few lines. There's another party tonight. Andre was right. It gets easier. Last time, I worked for 3 hours and made over $200 in tips. The other girls are nice, but one of them warned me about getting too close to Andre.
I think she's just jealous because he obviously likes me the best. He told me he's going to be producing a show for TV. Can you imagine what Nick would do if I had my own reality show? She would just die. Then Parker would feel like a real dipshit, wouldn't he? I know that name, Andre. Dara mentioned an Andre to me months ago. She had pictures of him on her phone. I flip forward another page. Dara's entry from the morning of the accident is even shorter. Damn it! I really thought I was getting over him. But today I woke up feeling like shit. Ariana says I should just go talk to Parker. I don't know. Maybe I will. Maybe Lick Me was right. I just can't fake my way out of this one. Or maybe I'm finally growing up. Images come back to me from that night. The rain slick and steel-colored on Parker's hood. The headlights cutting the world into blocks of light and shadow. Dara's look of triumph, as if she'd just crossed a finish line first. Forward. The entries stop for a while, and I flip past several blank pages. Dara shattered the bones in her right wrist in the accident. She couldn't hold a pen or even a fork. The next entry, the last one from the looks of it, dates from yesterday and is written in all capital letters, like a sign or something shouted. Dear Nick, I made up a game. It's called Catch Me If You Can. D. For a second, I can do nothing but stare at it, stunned. Reading the message over and over, torn between equal feelings of relief and anger. Anger wins. I slam the journal shut and stand up, hurling it across the room, where it thuds against the window and knocks an empty pencil cup from her desk on the way down. You think this is a fucking game? I say out loud, and then feel a sudden chill, as if someone has blown air down my back. That's almost exactly what Unknown said in response to my text. You think this is a fucking joke? I stand up, kicking my way through piles of her crap, looking for anything out of place, anything that might be a clue about where she's gone and why. Nothing. Just the usual clothing and garbage, the same tornado-style chaos Dara leaves behind everywhere. There are four new cardboard boxes piled in the corner. I guess Mom finally asked her to pick up her shit. But they're empty. I kick one of them and have a short-lived burst of satisfaction when it sails across the room and thuds against the opposite wall. I'm losing it. I take a deep breath and, standing in the corner, look again at her room, trying to mentally overlay an image of the room I saw just a few days ago. Like fitting slides together and seeing if something doesn't align. And then something clicks. There's a plastic bag at the foot of her bed I'm sure wasn't there earlier in the week. Inside the bag is a random assortment of stuff. A curling iron, a travel-size bottle of hairspray, a sparkly thong I remove with my pinky, not sure whether it's clean or dirty. Four business cards. All of them for random businesses like house painters or actuaries. I flip them all onto the bed, one by one, hoping to find some kind of message. The last card is for a bar, Beamer's. I know the place. It's right off the 101, a half mile south of Fanland, and only a mile or so up the coast from where Dara and I had our accident. I flip the card over, and right then the whole world sharpens and condenses, funnels down to a name, Andre, and a few numbers scratched in ballpoint. Again, I get that little twinge, like a hidden part of my brain is firing up. I know that number. I texted it less than 2 hours ago. You better keep your mouth shut or else. Weirdly, I don't even feel afraid. I don't feel much of anything at all. It's not even 11. And the drive to Beamer's will take me less than 20 minutes. Plenty of time. Nick, 11:35 p.m. As soon as I pull into the parking lot at Beamer's, I'm disappointed. I was hoping to see another clue, an immediate sign of Dara's connection to this place. But Beamer's looks like any one of the dozens of bars that clutter East Norwalk, only lonelier. This close to Orphan's Beach, where the currents are vicious and deadly. Visitors are fewer, and so are businesses. Still, the parking lot is full of cars. Flyers in the darkened windows advertise ladies' nights and drinks with names like Fuzzy Nipple, and a VIP party uncreatively named Blackout. There's even a velvet rope in front of the glass doors, which is ridiculous considering there's no one waiting to get in, and the single patron who lingers in the parking lot, smoking a cigarette and talking on his phone, is wearing dirty jeans and a sleeveless Budweiser shirt. I watch Budweiser stub his cigarette out in a bucket, presumably provided for that purpose, exhaling smoke through his nose, dragon style. I'm about to get out of the car and follow him when the door swings open, and I see a bouncer. Roughly the shape and size of a humpbacked whale, intercept Budweiser on his way in. Budweiser holds up his hand, probably showing him a stamp, and the bouncer withdraws. I hadn't counted on needing ID, but of course I do. For a moment, a wave of exhaustion hits me, and I think about turning around, angling the car back in the direction of home, leaving Dara to go to hell. But there's a stubborn part of me that refuses to give in so quickly. Besides, Dara doesn't have a fake, at least as far as I know. She always bragged she didn't need one and could flirt her way into any bar. If she can do it, I can do it too. I flip down the mirror, regretting now the plain scoop-neck tank top and shorts I changed into before leaving the house again. And the fact that I decided to skip anything but a little chapstick and some mascara. I look pale and young. I twist around and reach into the back seat. Like Dara's room, the upholstery is covered in a thick layer of accumulated clothing and trash. It doesn't take me long to find a sequined tank top, some lip gloss, and even a cracked 3-pack of dark eyeshadow. I smear on some dark color with a thumb, trying to remember what Dara always said the few times she convinced me to let her do my makeup, and I emerge from the bathroom unrecognizable and always vaguely uncomfortable, like she'd slipped me into a whole different skin. Blend from the bottom, go darker in the crease. I slick on some lip gloss, take my hair down from my ponytail and finger comb it, and, after checking to make sure that the parking lot is empty of people, swap out tank tops. Dara's sequined tank top hangs so low that a bit of my bra, black, thankfully, and not the printed yellow one I usually wear, with a coffee stain directly over my left nipple, peeks out from the top. I check my reflection one last time and get a momentary shock. Dressed in Dara's clothes, wearing Dara's makeup, I look more like her than I would have thought possible. I take a deep breath, grab my bag, and step out of the car. At least I changed out of my sneakers to go to dinner, knowing my dad would lecture me if I didn't. My gold gladiator sandals even have a teensy bit of a heel. The bouncer materializes even before I can get a hand on the door, seemingly rising out of the dark murk beyond the glass panes like an underwater creature surfacing. A rush of sound accompanies him out the door, thudding hip-hop music, women laughing, the chatter of dozens of drunk people.
ID,
he says, sounding bored. His eyes are at half-mast, low-lidded like a lizard's. I force a laugh. It sounds like someone's choking me with a garden hose.
Really?
I lower my chin, the way Dara always does when she wants something, and blink up at him. But I can feel my left leg twitching. I'll be 5 minutes, less. I just have to give my friend her wallet.
ID,
he repeats, like my words haven't even registered. Look, I say. He's keeping the door open with one foot, and I can just make out a portion of the bar behind him, dimly illuminated by badly unseasonal Christmas lights. Several girls are huddled together over some drinks. Is one of them Dara? It's too dark to tell. I'm not here to drink, okay? I'm just looking for my friend. You can watch me. I'll be in and out.
No ID, no entry.
He jerks a thumb toward the sign posted on the door, which reads exactly that. Beneath it is another posted sign. No shoes, no shirt. Big problem. You don't understand. Now I'm getting pissed, and for just a second, white-walled inside that hot flash of anger, something clicks, and I get it, and I slip into her skin without meaning to. I toss my hair and reach into my back pocket, extracting the business card I found in Dara's room. Andre invited me to come. It's a huge gamble. I don't know who Andre is or whether he even works here. He might just be some random sleazeball Dara met at the bar. In the photo on Dara's phone, he was wearing a leather jacket and watching Dara with an expression I didn't like. He might have simply grabbed a card to write down his number. But I'm coasting on instinct now, listening to a low hum of certainty buzzing somewhere deep in my brain. Why write down a number? Why not text it or program it into Dara's phone directly? There's a message in these numbers, I'm sure of it. A secret code, an invitation, a warning. The bouncer examines the card for what feels like an eternity, flipping it back to front, front to back, while I hold my breath, trying not to fidget. When he looks at me again, something has changed. His eyes tick slowly over my face and down to my tits, and I fight the urge to cross my arms. He's no longer bored. He's evaluating.
Inside, he grunts.
I wonder if his vocabulary is limited to the words he needs for the job. ID, inside, no, entry. He elbows the door open a little farther, so I just have room to slip by him. A blast of air conditioning greets me, and a heavy cloud of booze smells. My stomach tightens. What am I doing? More importantly, what's Dara doing? It's so loud I miss what the bouncer says when he next speaks. But he puts a hand on my elbow and points, gesturing me to follow him toward the back. The bar is crowded, mostly with guys who look at least a decade too old to be as loud and drunk as they are. There are padded red vinyl booths arranged on an elevated platform. One guy is groping his date while she sips a bright pink drink from the largest cup I've ever seen. A DJ is blasting bad house music from one corner, but there are also four TVs mounted behind the bar, and baseball playing on every one, as if Beamer's hasn't decided whether it wants to go for a full-on Eurotrash club scene or sports bar. My danger alarm is going off the charts. There's something off about the whole place, like it's not a real place but an imitation of a real place, a hastily constructed set piece meant to conceal something else. I scan the crowd, looking for Dara or even someone who looks like a friend of Dara's. But all the women are older, mid-20s at least. In her journal, Dara mentioned she was working for Andre. But all the waitresses, too, are older, strapped into micro miniskirts and tight tank tops with the Beamer's logo. Two headlights I'm pretty sure are meant to look like nipples, emblazoned across their boobs, looking bored or overwhelmed or just annoyed. I think of that picture of Dara on the couch, reclining, eyes glazed over, and my stomach knots up. We move down a narrow hall that leads to the bathrooms. The walls are papered with multicolored flyers. Wednesday, happy hour. 4th of July, bonanza. Ladies' night every Sunday. And more of the strangely monochromatic signs advertising blackout. And photographs. I'm half hoping I'll see a photo of Dara, and half praying I won't. But there must be 500 pictures on the wall, all of them practically identical. Tan girls in tank tops aiming kissy faces at the camera. Guys grinning over tequila shots. And we're moving too quickly for me to make out more than a dozen faces. None of them hers. At the end of the hall is a door marked private. The bouncer raps twice, and in response to a muffled command I again don't hear, swings open the door. I'm surprised to see a woman sitting behind a desk, in an office cluttered with boxes full of plastic straws and bar napkins printed with the Beamer's logo.
"Casey," the bouncer says. "A girl for Andre."
After shepherding me inside, he immediately abandons us. The door seals out most of the noise from outside. Still, I can feel the pulsating bass rhythm beating up through my feet.
"Sit down,"
the woman, Casey, says, her eyes glued to a computer screen.
"Give me a second. This fucking system."
She works her keyboard like she's trying to punch it to death, then abruptly shoves her computer aside. She's probably 40, with brown hair streaked blonde and a smudge of something, chocolate, on her upper lip. She looks like a guidance counselor, except for her eyes, which are a vivid, unnatural shade of blue.
"Okay," she says. "What can I do for you? Let me guess."
Her eyes sweep over me, landing on my chest, like the bouncers did.
"You're looking for a job."
I decide my best bet is to say nothing. I just nod.
"You 18?
She says. I nod again.
"Good, good."
She looks relieved, as if I've passed a test. "Because it's state law, you know. You have to be 21 to waitress, since we don't serve food. But for the private parties, we get to bend the rules." She's speaking so fast, I'm having trouble keeping up.
"You'll have to fill out an application and a disclaimer stating you're telling us the truth about your age."
She slides a piece of paper across the desk to me. Conspicuously, she doesn't ask for my ID, and the application just asks for my name, phone number, and email address, and to sign a statement guaranteeing that I'm of age. When I started work at Fanland, I thought they might ask me for a DNA swab. I hunch over the paper and act like I'm puzzling over it, when really I'm buying time and trying to figure out my next angle. "I don't have any waitressing experience," I say apologetically, as if it's just occurring to me. Behind Casey are a series of gray filing cabinets, some of them wedged open because their contents no longer fit. And I know that somewhere buried among all the files and invoices and cheesy Beamer's desktop mouse pads is Dara's application, the confident scrawl of her signature. I'm sure now. She sat here in this chair. Maybe she worked here before the accident. And it's no coincidence that on the night of her birthday, she vanished without taking her cell phone. It all leads back to this place, to this office, and to Casey with her bright smile and cold, dazzling eyes. To Andre. To those pictures and his threats.
"You think this is a fucking joke?"
"I need to know." Casey laughs.
"If you can walk and chew gum at the same time, you'll be fine. Like I said, we don't ask our hostesses to serve. It's against state law."
She leans back in her chair.
"How'd you hear about us, by the way?"
She keeps her voice light, but I can sense a sharp undercurrent running beneath the words. For a split second, my mind goes totally blank. I haven't prepared a cover story, and I have no idea what exactly I'm supposed to know. I feel like I'm fumbling to grab something slick in cold water. All I get is a rough shape, blunt edges. No details at all. I blurt, "I met Andre at a party. He mentioned it."
"Ah." She seems to relax fractionally. "Yeah. Andre's our GM and recruiter. He's in charge of our special events. I should warn you, though."
She leans forward again,
crossing her hands on the desk, doing the concerned guidance counselor right before she drops the bomb. You're failing chemistry. You didn't get into college. We don't have any upcoming parties. I can't say, in all honesty, when we'll be up and running again. Oh. I do my best to look disappointed, even though I'm still not sure exactly what she means by parties. Why not? She smiles thinly, but her expression stays guarded. We're ironing out some kinks, she says. Staffing problems. She emphasizes the last word slightly, and I can't help but think of the message Andre sent me, or sent Dara. You better keep your mouth shut, or else. Is Dara one of his problems? For a second, I imagine that Casey knows exactly who I am and what I've come for. Then, mercifully, she looks away, returning her attention to the computer. I won't bore you with the details, she says. If you want to go ahead and write down your phone number, we'll give you a call when we need you. She jerks her head toward the one-page application, which I have yet to fill out. And just like that, I know I've been dismissed. But I can't go yet. Not when I've learned nothing. Is Andre here? I say desperately, before I've made the decision to ask. Can I talk to him? She's gone back to typing. Now she stiffens, her fingers hovering over the keys. You can talk to him. This time when she looks at me, she squints, as if seeing me from a far distance. I look away, blushing, hoping she won't see the resemblance to Dara. Now I regret making myself up like her. But he'll tell you the same thing I did. Please, I say, and then so she won't suspect how desperate I am, quickly add. It's just, I really need the money. She scrutinizes me for a second longer. Then, to my surprise, she laughs. Don't we all? She says, winking. Okay, then. You know where to find him? Down the stairs, across from the ladies. But don't say I didn't warn you. And don't forget to drop off your application with me before you leave. I won't, I say, standing up so quickly the chair screeches against the floor. I mean, thanks. Back in the hall, I pause for a moment, disoriented in the sudden darkness. Up ahead, the disco light is whirling, sending showers of purple light around a mostly empty dance floor. The music is so loud it makes my head hurt. Why would anyone come here? Why did Dara come here? I close my eyes and think back to the days before the accident. Weirdly, the only thing that comes is an image of Parker's car, and that fogged-up windshield, the rain fizzing on the glass. We didn't mean to. I open my eyes again. Two girls spill out of the bathroom, holding hands and giggling. As soon as they start down the hall, I slip after them, noticing for the first time a dark alcove immediately across from the ladies' sign, and stairs leading down to the basement. The stairs corkscrew around a small, bare landing and abruptly turn from wood to concrete. Another few steps and I'm deposited in a long, unfinished hallway with cinder block walls and a paint-splattered concrete floor. The whole basement feels forgotten and disused. In a horror film, this would be where the blonde girl goes to die in the opening scene. I shiver in the sudden chill. It's cold down here and smells like all basements, like moisture barely contained. Naked bulbs encased in mesh hang from the ceiling, and the music is nothing but a dull thudding, like a monster's distant heartbeat. Boxes are heaped at the far end of the hallway, and through one half-open door I see what must be the staff changing room. Grim gray lockers, several pairs of sneakers lined up under a bench, and a cell phone buzzing forlornly, performing a quarter-turn rotation on the wood when it does. I get the sudden, prickly feeling of being watched, and I spin around, half expecting someone to jump out at me. No one. Still, my heart rate won't return to normal. I'm about to return upstairs, thinking I must have misunderstood Casey's directions, when voices down the hall crest sharply, suddenly over the music. Even though I don't hear a single word, I immediately know. An argument. I continue down the hall, moving carefully, holding my breath. With every step, the itch in my skin gets worse, as if invisible people are leaning forward to breathe on me. I remember then, the time Parker dared Dara and me to walk across the graveyard off Cressida Circle at night when we were kids. "But go quietly," he said, dropping his voice. "Or they'll reach out, and..." He seized me suddenly by the waist and I screamed. Afterward, he couldn't stop laughing. Still, I never did walk across the graveyard, too afraid that if I did, a hand would reach out and grab me, pulling me down into the rotten earth. I pass another door, this one gaping open to reveal a dingy bathroom with caulk oozing like thick caterpillars between cracks in the wall. By now the voices are louder. There is a final door, this one closed, a few feet farther on. This must be Andre's office. The voices abruptly go silent, and I freeze, holding my breath, wondering if I've been detected. Debating whether I should knock or turn around and run. Then a girl says, quietly but very clearly, "The police grilled me for, like, 4 hours, and I didn't have anything to tell them. I couldn't tell them anything." A male voice, Andre, replies,
"So what the hell are you worried about?"
"She's my best friend. She was drunk. She doesn't even remember getting home, and her sister's missing. Of course I'm fucking worried." My heart stops beating for the space of a breath. A name. Madeline Snow. They're talking about Madeline Snow.
"Lower your voice.
And don't feed me some horse shit. You're trying to cover your ass, but you knew what you were getting into when you signed up." "You said everything would be private. You said no one would know."
"I told you to lower your voice."
But it's too late. Her voice is rising in pitch like steam being forced through a kettle. "So what did happen that night, huh? Because if you know something, you have to talk. You have to tell me." There's a moment of silence. My heart is drumming hard in my throat, like a fist trying to punch its way out. "Fine." Her voice is shaking now, skipping registers. "Fine. Then don't tell me. I guess you can just wait until the police knock down your door." The door handle rattles and I jump backward, pressing myself against the wall, as if it will keep me invisible. Then there's a scraping noise, the sound of a chair jumping backward, and the door handle falls still. Andre says, "I don't know what the hell happened to that little girl." The way he says "little girl" makes me feel sick. Like I've accidentally eaten something rotten. "But if I did know, if I do know, you really think it's a smart idea to come around here playing Nancy Drew? You think I don't know how to make problems disappear?" There's a short pause. "Are you threatening me? Because I'm not afraid of you." This last part is obviously a lie. Even through the door, I can hear that the girl's voice is shaking.
"Then you're dumber than I thought,"
Andre says.
"Now get the fuck out of my office."
Before I can retreat or react, the door swings open so hard it cracks against the wall, and a girl comes rushing out. Her head is down, but still I recognize her immediately from the paper. The pale skin, the straight fringe of black bangs, and the red lipstick. Like she's auditioning for a part in a movie about a vampire from the 1920s. It's Sarah Snow's best friend, the girl who supposedly accompanied her to get ice cream the night Madeline disappeared. She pushes past me roughly and doesn't even stop to apologize. And before I can call out to her, she's gone, darting animal-like up the stairs. I want to go after her, but Andre has already seen me.
What do you want?
His eyes are bloodshot. He looks tired, impatient. It's him. The guy from the photo. Leather jacket guy.
He's nobody,
Dara said months ago.
They're all nobodies. They don't matter.
But she was wrong about this one. I try to see him as Dara might have. He's older, maybe early 20s, and his hair is already thinning, although he gels it stiff to conceal the fact. He's good-looking in an obvious way, like someone who spends a lot of time flossing. His lips are too thin.
Casey sent me down here, I blurt. I mean, I was looking for the bathroom.
What?
Andre squints at me. He takes up most of the doorway. He's big, at least 6'4", with hands like meat cleavers. My heart is still going, hard. He knows what happened to Madeline Snow. It's not a suspicion. It's a certainty. He knows what happened to Madeline Snow, and he knows where Dara is, and he takes care of problems. It suddenly occurs to me that no one would hear me if I screamed. The music upstairs is too loud.
You looking for a job?
Andre says when I don't respond, and I realize that I'm still holding this stupid application.
Yes. No, I mean, I was.
I shove the paper into my bag.
But Casey said you guys aren't doing parties right now.
Andre's watching me sideways, like a snake watching a mouse move closer and closer.
We're not, he says.
His eyes go over my whole body, slowly, like a long, careful touch. He smiles then, a megawatt movie star smile, a smile to make people say yes.
But how about you come in and sit down? Never know when we're going to start up again.
That's okay, I say quickly. I was kind of looking for a position right now.
Andre's still smiling, but something shifts behind his eyes. It's like the friendly switch has just cut off. Now his smile is cold, scrutinizing, suspicious.
Hey,
he says, pointing a finger at me, and the certainty yawns open in my stomach. He recognizes me. He knows I'm Dara's sister. He knows I came to find her. All this time, he's been screwing with me.
Hey, you look familiar.
Don't I know you?
I don't answer. I can't. He knows. Without meaning to move, I take off down the hall, walking as quickly as I can without breaking into a run, taking the stairs two at a time. I burst onto the dance floor, pinballing off a guy dressed in a dark purple suit who reeks of cologne.
Why the hurry?
He calls after me, laughing. I dodge a small knot of girls swaying drunkenly in heels, squealing along with the song lyrics. Luckily, the bouncer has temporarily abandoned his post. Maybe it's too late for new arrivals. I push out into the thick night air, heavy with moisture and salt, taking deep and grateful breaths, like someone emerging from underwater. The lot is still packed with cars, a tight Tetris formation bumper to bumper, too many cars for the number of people inside. For one disorienting second, I can't remember where I parked. I fish my keys from my bag, clicking the car open, feeling reassured when I hear the familiar beep and see headlights blink expectantly at me. I jog toward the car, weaving between cars. Suddenly, I'm blinded by the sweep of headlights. A small, dark VW cuts by me, spitting gravel. And as it passes underneath the light,
I see Sarah Snow's friend hunched behind the wheel. Her name, heard or read a dozen times in the past 10 days, returns to me suddenly. Kennedy. I thud a hand down on her trunk before she can fully bypass me.
Wait!
She slams on the brakes. I circle around to the driver's side, keeping one hand on her car the whole time, as if it will prevent her from driving away.
Wait!
I haven't even planned what I'm going to say. But she has answers. I know she does.
Please!
I place my hand flat on the window. She jerks backward an inch, like she's expecting me to reach through the glass and hit her. But after a second, she buzzes down the window.
What?
She's holding onto the wheel with both hands, as if she's afraid it might jump out of her hands.
What do you want?
I know you lied about the night Madeline disappeared. The words are out of my mouth before I know I've even been thinking them. Kennedy inhales sharply.
You and Sarah came here.
It's a statement, not a question. But Kennedy nods, a movement so small I almost miss it.
How did you know?
She says in a whisper. Her expression turns fearful.
Who are you?
My sister. My voice cracks. I swallow down the taste of sawdust. I have 1,000 questions, but can't make a single one come into focus. My sister works here, or at least she used to work here. I think she's in trouble. I think something bad may have happened to her. I'm watching Kennedy's face for signs of recognition or guilt. But she's still staring up at me with huge, hollowed eyes, as if I'm the one to be afraid of. Something like what happened to Madeline. Immediately I know it was the wrong thing to say. Now she doesn't look afraid. She looks angry.
I don't know anything,
she says firmly, as if it's a line she's been practicing repeatedly. She starts to buzz up the window.
Just leave me alone. Wait!
Out of desperation, I stick my hand in the narrowing gap between the car door and the window. Kennedy lets out a hiss of irritation, but at least she rolls the window down again.
I need your help. I told you, I don't know anything.
She's losing it again, like she did downstairs in Andre's office. Her voice hitches higher, wobbling over the words.
I left early that night. I thought Sarah had gone home. She was drunk. That's what I thought. When I came into the parking lot and saw the car door hanging open, that Sarah had been too wasted to remember to close it. That she'd taken Maddie home in a cab.
I imagine the car, the open door, the empty back seat. Light spilling from beamers just like it is tonight. The muffled thud of music. The distant crash of waves. Up the street, the peaked roof of an Applebee's, a few low-rent condominiums clinging to the shore, a diner and a surf shop. Across the street, a greasy clam shack, a former t-shirt shop, now in foreclosure. Everything is so normal, so relentlessly the same. It's almost impossible to believe in all the bad things, the tragedies, the dark fairy tale twists. One second she was there, the next she was gone. Without realizing it, I've been holding on to the car, as if it will help me keep on my feet. To my surprise, Kennedy reaches out and grips my hand. Her fingers are icy.
I didn't know.
Even though she's whispering, this is it. The high note. The crescendo.
It wasn't my fault. It wasn't my fault.
Her eyes are huge and dark, mirrors of the sky. For a second, we stand there, only inches apart, staring at each other. And I know that in some way, we understand each other.
It wasn't your fault,
I say. Because I know that this is what she wants, or needs me to tell her. She withdraws her hand, sighing a little, like someone who's been walking all day and finally gets to sit.
Hey!
I whip around and freeze. Andre is just pushed out of the front doors. Backlit, he seems to be made wholly of shadow.
Hey, you!
Shit! Kennedy twists around in her seat.
Go!
She says to me, her voice low, urgent. Then the window zips up and she guns it, her tires skidding a little on the gravel. I have to jump backward to keep from getting crushed. I bang my shin on a license plate, feel a dull nip of pain in my leg.
Hey, you, stop.
Panic makes me slow. I skid across the lot, regretting my sandals now. My body feels unwieldy, bloated and foreign. Like in those nightmares where you try to run and find you haven't gone anywhere. Andre is fast. I can hear his footsteps pounding on the gravel as he ricochets between parked cars. I reach the car at last and hurl myself inside. My fingers are shaking so badly it takes me 3 tries to get the keys in the ignition. But I do, finally, and wrench the gear into reverse.
Stop!
Andre slams up against my window, palms flat, face contorted with rage, and I scream. I punch down on the gas, whipping away from him even as he drums a fist against my hood.
Stop, damn it!
I throw the gear into drive, cutting the wheel to the left, my palms slick with sweat, even though my whole body is freezing. Little whimpers are working their way out of my throat, spasms of sound. He makes a final lunge at me, as if to throw himself in front of the car. But I'm already pulling away, bumping onto Route 101 and flooring it, watching the speedometer slowly tick upward. Come on, come on, come on. I half expect him to appear again on the road, but I check the rearview mirror and see nothing but empty highway. And then the road curves and bears me away from Beamer's, away from Andre, toward home.